this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey guys, welcome back to Y'allitics here. I am back with you this week. Wheeler had it all to himself last week. I don't know if he can hear me right now. Jason, can you even hear me?
Sadly, yes, I can hear you. It's good to have you back. I missed you last week when I was doing all the work for both of us.
I bet you did, man. I'm glad you did some work here. listen, we're going to forego the pint we normally have this week because we have a guest that I've wanted to talk to for a while now. A friend of mine at the Texas Tribune, Ian Mitra, he's the senior managing editor now at the Texas Tribune. He emailed me just before the holidays and said, listen, we just talked to a guy named Craig Garnett. He's the publisher of the Uvalde Leader News in Uvalde, Texas. And he said, I think you guys really ought to get him on Y'allitics because his story about his brand new book is so compelling. So we have with us on the line right now from Uvalde, we have Craig Garnett. You've owned the Uvalde Leader News since 1989. And before that, you worked there 7 years prior to that, is what I read as well. And your weekly editorials and columns have won awards. I have read part of your brand new book called Uvalde's Darkest Hour. I've read excerpts from it, and I can see why your writing has won awards because, my friend, it is very, very moving. So thank you so much, Craig, for joining us on Y'allitics here.
Jason, thank you for that kind introduction.
Craig, can we start off with why you wrote the book? I mean, so much has been said about Uvalde. It still feels like, you know, as we come up on the 3-year anniversary of that horrible massacre at Robb Elementary in May of this year, it seems like we've learned so much, but there's still so much that hasn't been filled in. There's so many blanks here for the public that haven't been filled in. What made you write this?
Well, as I've said before in different interviews, the magnitude of the tragedy was such that over time, as days went by, and that particular magnitude began to grow, I didn't feel like I had the capacity, or we had the capacity at our paper, to include all the information that was coming to light. There were so many revelations, if you will, in terms of the law enforcement failure as the days took by, and then the school district itself, the failings that they were credited with, that came out in the Texas House report, which came 2 months after the attack. And it was around that time that I decided that with all this information at hand, we could not possibly fit it in our twice a week paper. At that time, we were twice a week. I said, we were working, you know, overtime to try to do a comprehensive job, but it was just so detailed and so layered that I felt like I had to put it in a book to create a public record of what happened in our community.
And essentially what you put in the book was you'd been keeping a journal as you were going through those days. And the journal was really just, wasn't it just sort of trying to keep up with the events that were happening, because so much was happening in such a compressed time frame that it's almost like you had to keep yourself straight by entering into this journal?
Yeah, it was a daily calendar of what news broke that particular day, or what sentiments were ascendant in the community. And that was my way of committing to memory and also sort of clearing my mind and putting a place marker on that particular day's events. So yeah, that was a build up. And then the Texas House report sort of pushed me over the line that, you know, I've got to write about this in something, a more comprehensive document. Mm.
Craig, do you remember your first journal entry that you tapped out on your laptop or on your iPhone, the first day that you decided, hey, I need to make sure I keep all this straight because it's moving so fast?
Probably it was the governor's appearance at the high school, where he said, you know, it could have been much worse. You know, when you hear that, and already by then we knew that there was far more to the story than we were getting from law enforcement. Just by virtue of the parents who'd been there.
When you heard that, because we heard it, And you know, everyone heard it at the time. And the governor since said, oh, well, I didn't have my facts straight about the law enforcement response. But when you heard that, knowing what your community was going through, what your own staff was going through, what was your reaction when the governor said that?
You know, we were taken aback. But I will say that we didn't know the depth of the error at that point. We knew that it was wrong. We knew that he was already beginning to cover up for what happened in terms of his agency. So it was disturbing.
Let me take you back just a moment. You said it was that House report that really pushed you over the line and made you think, I've got to dedicate this all into a book. What do you mean by that? That House report was pretty scathing. It talked about the law enforcement failures. You had almost 400 officers who were there that day. They waited more than 70 minutes, as we all know by now, to go into that classroom. There were failings at the, as you mentioned, the school district level. The safety protocols weren't necessarily followed there in so many cases. What was it about that House report that, was it the House report itself that you thought was inadequate and needed to be expanded upon, or that you felt like people should know more about what they had just highlighted?
Well, I felt like the House report was a bit of a tripwire as far as what had happened and what was going to continue to happen. And the institutional failures that it pointed to in the school district and the city, with the city police department, the school police department, the lack of adequate security, the lack of doors that locked, the lack fact there wasn't a resource officer on the campus, although we had some. All that stuff told me that this tragedy was not just these deaths. It was our institutional failures in our community.
Craig, I'm curious, and I have a lot of questions about the book here too, but for people who think they know this story, what will readers get from opening your book called Uvalde's Darkest Hour?
I have had feedback from people in town, quite a few, who said, even in this community, who were reading our paper, say, I had no idea the level of failure. I had no idea about this particular detail or that. And I'm finding the book to be very much of an eye-opener in terms of things that and not been discussed. So I think for the very reason I wrote it, I think the book gives you a tremendous amount of insight into things that you couldn't have picked up day by day.
And what I think is fascinating about the book too, you don't just go through the law enforcement failures, the door that was open, things like that. You also talk about the victims, and you talk about them from, you know, a very human standpoint. You make these children, you know, really come alive in the book.
Well, I'm glad, because that was much of the point, is to put the human face on this tragedy, that these kids and these survivors, you know, what they're dealing with today. I don't think people understand the ripple effect of a school shooting. You know, they think, okay, we've lost, you know, 200 kids in 20 years or whatever the number is. But there have been 400,000 children exposed to guns in a class. That's important to consider.
Hmm. And can you tell us more about that? You said the ripple effect. What is the ripple effect of the survivors and the faculty and folks like that in Uvalde? What is it today?
The ripple effect is that our attendance is way down. We've got kids that still won't go to school. We've got other families that saw what happened and they're still worried about security. It just continues to play out. And in the ripple effect, you know, after Rob, there were several incidents in San Antonio where parents rushed to the school because there was a warning of an active shooter, which was a fraud. But the parents were terrified. And I think you have this on a national level. You've seen it in Nashville. You've seen any place there's been a shooting. The follow-up to that is more anxiety, more lack of attendance. School shootings are a national nightmare.
Yeah, there's a real difficulty too for the individual communities, Craig, because what happens is the whole world descends on your community right after this happens. You've got, you know, media from all over the place. You've got all of these elected officials coming through. You've got this crime scene that's being processed still, families just in disbelief and grief. And then all of those outside people leave after it's over with, and the state eventually, you know, quote unquote, moves on, the country moves on, but your city is still stuck in it. And it's generational almost. I mean, you know, with a tragedy of this scope, it touches so many people in that small town. The healing just takes unbelievably long.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, on the surface, you would say, well, Uvalde's better. You know, we're having our, you know, our, we have our hunters roundup. We have our Chamber of Commerce banquet coming up. We do all the perfunctory things that are required. Mm. But beneath the surface, there's still so much anxiety and so much grief. Yeah.
And you mentioned a moment ago some of the reaction you've had, but I'm curious about the reaction you've had from the victims' families, from the other survivors there at the school that day, teachers, faculty, and just the community in general. What have people said? Because the book came out, I believe, the 1st of December from Texas A&M Press, and it hasn't been out but, what, 6-7 weeks or so. What are people saying to you?
Well, I mean, again, the feedback has been largely that they really appreciate the fact that I wrote it, that, again, they were not aware of some of the things that happened. That's locally, or the people that I've spoken to. There are others locally who probably resent the book. It doesn't.
Why so?
That doesn't help us move forward. They're going to close the chapter, finish it. No books needed. You know what happened? It's over. We got to get on with our lives. And I understand that feeling. I mean, that's human nature, to try to gather yourself and make the future brighter. But I don't think you don't have closure or healing until you understand what happened and how we can make that particular part of it better with our.
You've sort of dealt with that as you've gone here, though, haven't you, as well? I mean, being the publisher of the newspaper there, haven't there been people who've said, hey, would you stop already with these Robb mm-hmm. Elementary stories like that? We need to move on.
That's in the book. You know, the woman who mm-hmm. approached me and said, look, I'll get you 100 new subscribers if you can stop this young woman who was our reporter who's lost her daughter, if you can stop her talking about it, stop her from being an advocate, you know, for gun safety, largely is what she's saying. Yeah, we got that kind of feedback and you know, still, so you know, it's still there. It's not as manifest as it was probably, or as vocal, but it, you know, it's art in the tragedy.
Mm-hmm. And that mother is Lexi Rubio's mom. She was a victim in the school shooting, and her mother is a reporter for you. She was she left for a year, I believe, and then came back. Can you tell us about how you mentioned she's writing a lot of gun safety and trying to you know, keep this in the forefront? But is that kind of where she's focusing on these days?
Jason, she came back to us, but not as a reporter. She's in our advertising department. She didn't feel comfortable with the idea of reporting in Uvalde after what happened, obviously, for obvious reasons. But she's extremely involved in advocacy. She and two other of the survivors of the victims' family members are part of a group called Lives Robbed. Kimberly just came back from Washington, D.C. this week. She'd been there working, advocating. So that's her method of trying to heal. To be a voice for Lexi. I'll say this, Lexi's great-grandfather, who gave the eulogy for her, did her service, came in the paper last week, and he wanted me to sign the book for him. Hmm. And he said, Craig, I've read the book 3 times. Thank you for writing. So, you know, that's about all I need for confirmation that it was important.
You get choked up when you're talking about that. That, I mean, that's hugely meaningful.
Yeah, Jason, it doesn't. Yeah, it just doesn't go away. You know, and I feel it for them.
Can you talk a little bit about, I think it's really interesting what you went through as far as publishing goes. So you put this book together, and I guess for people who aren't, you know, really familiar with the book writing process, a lot of times, you know, you do the publishing part on the front end, you know, where you shop around an idea or you make a deal and then you write the book. How did this go for you? What was interest like out there when you told folks that you had this?
Well, I did it backwards, obviously, which is not a natural for me, but I wrote the book and then we're looking for a first for an agent and then for a publisher, you know, by that was his job. I went to, you know, I did a Google search and got the biggest houses in New York and I sent my queries and I think I had 4 or 5 chapters. I'd written most of the book. And they said, well, you know, look, bud, you know, it's some pretty good writing, but it's not commercially viable. People don't read steel shooting books. It's too depressing. Hmm. And I said, well, I get that. Cookbooks and, you know, how to improve, but this is how to improve also, you know. So anyway, that didn't work. And ultimately, I found a man in Austin, Falcon Literary, Mark Falcon. And I sent him the query letter and some chapters, and he immediately got back with me and said, I love this book. He said, I've got kids in school. This is a Texas story, and we need to tell it.
How many journal entries make up the book, Greg?
Oh, the journal entries, they're not keyed to chapters. They're simply place markers for me to add information as it happened chronologically.
And everyone who crafts or creates anything has something that really stands out to them. What do you think that is for you in this book? Is there something that's there in there that's hard for you to read again or to go back and look at or anything like that?
It's hard for me to read the chapter with the response at the school, with the parents leading, with the officers, to just to go in and to hear Chloe Tortoise calling on the phone for 46 minutes, pleading with dispatch to please send the police. Are they coming yet? Are they coming? And to talk to her father, Reuben, about it. The only time he ever cried was when he went to the courthouse to visit with the DA, and for the first time, he heard his daughter's 911 calls. This is a former combat Marine. Reading that chapter about survivors with him talking about how he trained Chloe to be a survivor, that's hard to read. It's hard.
I'm sorry. She was one of the teachers in the classroom who made that phone call.
And she was a student. She was a 10-year-old.
I'm sorry. The student in the classroom.
Chloe Tortoise. Yeah.
But it's important reading, isn't it? Because, you know, as you mentioned, you know, everybody who puts a book out into the world wants it to do something in the world. And what good are the lessons if they're not learned?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the book is there for that. Take the lessons that it presents. That's all I can hope for.
I wanted to know, a lot of times, I guess, in a case like this, especially when you've been so personally attached to a story for so long and you've covered it, and it has obviously been hard on you and hard on everyone there who has touched this, it can be cathartic to put this stuff into words and to put it into print. Was it hard for you when the book writing came to an end?
You know, I guess in some ways it was, Jason, but at the same time, I was still writing. I mean, I'm still writing commentary and editorials. So I had an outlet. There was a Jesse Prado report that came out last year in February, March, that followed the government report, the DOJ report. That didn't get into the book, and I wish it had. Because that was a very unsettling time in our community.
Jason mentioned a moment ago. I'm sorry, Craig. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's fine.
Jason mentioned a moment ago at the beginning of this episode that we're coming up on 3 years, and it's kind of hard to believe. But what do you expect this anniversary to be? I hate to use the word anniversary, but what do you expect this to be like on May 22nd, 2025?
We use the word mark here. There will be another probably candlelight ceremony at the amphitheater in the park, which has been a beautiful celebration of life for these kids. I would suspect they'll do that again. Traditionally, they do a mural walk where the family walk among the murals of the children, and they do that alone for obvious reasons. So I think there'll probably be something along those lines. You know, it last year it was a bit less of a participation, but I would project that the trajectory will continue to decline over time, simply because that's how we're made as humans. But there will be a recognition.
Now, those murals of the children there, by the way, that was a big part of the healing process.
Yes, sir, it was, and it still is. I mean, I would think, and I think I say in the book, that it was probably the most moving and important project encompassing the whole town that worked toward healing. Mm-hmm. Every day now you can drive and enjoy seeing these children.
We had one of the people who was instrumental in getting the new campus built there in Uvalde. Obviously, you know, classes couldn't just go back to Robb Elementary after this. Where do we stand with that? How are things now?
They're coming right along on the construction. It looks as though it'll open in the fall in time, maybe for this new next school year. Maybe a few months late. You never know with construction, but it's largely built. They're working on the interior now, and it's going to be it'll be a wonderful addition, I think, for children to go in there.
Greg, as we talk about the passage of time here, one thing that as a political reporter that completely disgusts me is the fact that there was no accountability in this. And sure, people say, oh, well, you know, there was somebody who was suspended from DPS. But when you zoom out here, I don't have to tell you this, you know this, but for our listeners, there has not been any accountability for the law enforcement failures that happened there. The state law enforcement failures, the local ones, there have been for Peter Arredondo, who was the school district police chief. But how does that sit today, 3 years later, in the community? Because it's a small community, and you pointed out that a lot of the people who had children who perished in this also are connected to law enforcement in some way.
Yeah, I think there's that group without doubt is unhappy that there hasn't been more accountability. There were two people indicted, Arredondo and his right-hand guy, another school officer. We're going through that process of hearings and whatnot, you know, trying to change a venue. But the fact of the matter is there probably will be more negative sentiment surrounding this event outside of Uvalde than there would be within.
Really? How so?
Well, people on the outside, I think, had a better grasp on the totality of the failure because there weren't relationships involved. In the community, you see there's so many families that have law enforcement in them. And so they had people, there were families who lost kids who had law enforcement as members of their extended family. And anytime you have those relationships, you know, people tend to pull back. They're like, wait a minute, you know, I know this man, he's a human. He may not have gone in that day, but he doesn't deserve to be punished.
Wow, that's a dynamic I wouldn't think a lot of people would imagine is in place there, but it is. You know, speaking about the law enforcement end of this, for so long, so much of this has been tied up under, you know, this cloak of secrecy as the DA there has, you know, been looking at the case for a very long time. We've gotten some of this video, some of these details, largely because of media organizations that have pushed and pushed to get these things. And there have been some leaks of some of these pieces of information. As a journalist, you know, you get a sense for this. This is your community. You've done this for a long time. How much of this story is still yet to be told and fully understood? You know, there's so much of this video that we haven't seen. How much of this is still left to be told?
Well, there's a lot of video that we haven't had access to because, as you point out, it's been tied up to the DA's office, you know, and that's still there. And, you know, the fear is that they can sit on that forever. You know, as long as they can claim litigation or investigation, and that happens very often. The fact is, without the information that was leaked early on, we never would have had a grasp of exactly how much failure was involved. Those videos in the hallway, those radio calls, you see, you didn't get those at other places like Pulse, you know, and that really opened the door in Uvalde for us to fully understand.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, sure. Being a longtime journalist, you know that investigations, yes, are one thing. You do have to protect the integrity of an investigation. But at the same time, that can very easily, that excuse can very easily be used as a fig leaf to create a cover up.
Absolutely. And it happens every day. You know, we use the Associated Press as our guidebook. And this year in the new guidebook, they totally rewrote the crime reporting aspect. Not totally, but to a large extent. And right off the bat, they say to you, look, law enforcement's not going to be on the level. Hmm. Be prepared to understand what they're about. It's not saying they're bad people. It's not saying they can't do their job, but they're not going to square with you, the press. And boy, we got that lesson.
That's a good point. And for our viewers who may not be following as closely as all three of us are, the district attorney in Uvalde still has not released this information. And it's remarkable because the suspect in this case is dead. So a lot of people are asking, what's the holdup on this? Why aren't you releasing this? I'm curious to get your take on that. Why do you think the DA is not releasing this yet? And secondly, I'm curious, Craig, what more do you think is in there?
You know, we asked for the school records right off the bat of the shooter, and we're yet to get those. And, you know, FERPA, you know, their protections, FERPA, you know, if the child is under 18 and he's alive, you got to protect it. This kid was over 18 and he's dead. But immediately the walls went up on that from our school district. You know, we did a 6-month investigation into special education where he should have been and wasn't. And part of that was we requested his records, and we still haven't gotten a full accounting of that. So it's a battle.
That's staggering. So we have this shooter who is gone. And you can't get that to this day, almost 3 years later. You still haven't gotten that.
We still haven't gotten the full accounting. That's why. Huh.
What is the chatter there about why the DA still hasn't released anything? I mean, you're a lot closer to it than we are. You probably hear chatter quite a bit about this. What are people saying?
You know, it's been pretty quiet, honestly, Jason. On that level, I think people are sort of expended their energies to some extent. Other people, again, on the outside, press more probably than they do here. I mean, we make contact from time to time, and we get that, you know, it's still ongoing, and there are lawsuits for sure, a lot of civil litigation. But the criminal aspect of it, you would think the book's closed. I mean, the DA convened a special grand jury that was in place for 3 months. They looked at all the evidence. Not all of the evidence, obviously, because there are only two guys charged, at least from our point of view. But yeah, it's just stuck in time.
Craig, it seems like that this, you know, as we said, you know, a lot of the media that, you know, parachuted in when this happened and, you know, got on the ground and started, you know, trying to report this story out as the facts were unfolding, they've left. They left a long time ago. Your organization is still there doing this. The Uvalde Leader News still trying to wrap its arms around this story that continues to unfold. How big of a challenge is this? I mean, I would imagine that you don't have a New York Times staff size there. I mean, how hard is it to keep up with this?
Been a real challenge, Jason, I'll tell you. We got a reporter from RFA, which is Report for America, a year after the event. And she did a tremendous job of helping us out. She was with us for about a year and a half. Absent her being on the scene, I don't know, we could not have possibly have chased every lead that we needed to chase. Mm-hmm. And now we're kind of rebuilding after her departure. We're looking for another reporter. We've been granted one. They'll come on board in the summer. But it's very difficult, honestly.
Yeah, in the middle of the devastation of all of this in your community, and you're trying to process that, you've got staffers who have actually lost someone in this shooting. So you're trying to process that and deal with that and be there for them. But at the same time, you're trying to keep a community informed there that is turning to you to get the facts on this. You guys were a twice a week paper, and you had to pivot. I mean, in the middle of all of this, you're trying to make, you know, business decisions on, oh my God, we can't do this the way we've always done this. We're going to have to pivot and do something different.
Yeah. Yeah. We reduced our publication to once a week at the beginning of last year. That was just absolutely because of business reasons, trying to conserve our energy and our money to keep going.
And so does everything go to digital now? Is that the focus more? I mean, it seems like you have so many developments that that's the only way to keep up with it.
Yeah, well, it's digital first now, and that really came about more or less in the days and weeks after Rob, because all of our competitors, who were legions, were 24/7, and you know, it really wasn't our story to break twice a week. That's not viable. So yeah, we got a lesson firsthand. We got a master class in what digital's supposed to look like. We didn't have the resources to completely implement it or make that transition. We're still trying to do that. And I think that's true across the country for many legacy print companies.
Yeah, I think you're right. You guys are doing a fantastic job. The last question I had, Craig, is you've been doing this a long time. You got there in 82, and you've owned the Uvalde Leader News since 1989. Every journalist has covered things that stick with them forever. I'm just curious how this has changed you.
Well, my wife says I'm a more serious person than I used to be. I don't know if that's a euphemism for something else, but that's certainly a description. So I was thinking about retiring before Rob, and I was, 70 years old, and I thought, okay, this has been a good ride. I had no idea.
That's my last question for you. When you go through something like this, it would be easy at this point, since you've sort of shepherded this paper through this period of time, you've written the book now. Do you think, is it, time for me to just be able to step away and not to have to hear from somebody I run into at the market who says, hey, would you guys stop printing these stories? It's inconvenient. We'd like to move on. Do you ever think about, is it time?
Sure. Yeah. I do. I just haven't reached that time yet.
And why is that? Because are you still pulled by, what we've been talking about, and that is all the blanks that still have yet to be filled in?
Yeah, I still feel like there's work to be done that I have an inside track on, perhaps, or our staff does. And so I just don't feel like we can walk away from this project.
When you say inside track, is there stuff imminently that we should expect in the months ahead?
No investigation that's going to pop out next week, but we are always working on things. Yes. Thank you.
There is a lot more work to be done, and we're thankful that you guys are on top of that, Craig. And for people who are listening to this, you can find the latest you guys are covering constantly. UvaldeLeaderNews.com is where you guys are located. We have Craig Garnett with us, the owner and publisher of the Uvalde Leader News. His latest book, newest book, is called Uvalde's Darkest Hour. And Craig, before we let you go, where can people find your book?
It's on Amazon. You can get it the next day. They're having a sale today, I think, so.
And Craig, the proceeds for this go to something very special.
Yeah, they're going to go to a permanent Rob Memorial Fund. It's not been established yet. We don't know what that's going to look like, but that's where my portion is going to go. And it may be $20 and it may be $1,000. I don't know, but whatever, something.
Well, good on you for doing it. Craig, thank you so much for being with us, and all the best to you, all the best to everyone there in Uvalde. I know it feels like everyone has moved on, but our hearts are still with you all.
Thank you for that sentiment, and thank you for what you're doing at Yolitics.
Thanks a lot, Craig. Keep it up too, man. I love the fact that you guys are on this, so keep it up.
Thank you. Thank you to both Jasons.
Thanks, Craig.
Click subscribe and get Yolitics every week. Eolitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.